Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Hello, podcasters. Welcome to Living History as we hear those stirring words from Winston Churchill spoken in 1940. It's definitely the greatest speech of the Second World War and probably one of the greatest speeches ever given. And it was those words that galvanized the British people and prepared them for the upcoming Battle of Britain. France had fallen, the Nazis occupied all of Western Europe, and Britain was next in their sights. And the Battle of Britain, of course, that unfolded was the great aerial contest to see who would dominate the skies over Great Britain. And as we know, it didn't work out for the Germans. The Luftwaffe was defeated in the Battle of Britain. They never gained aerial superiority over the Royal Air Force. And Hitler therefore indefinitely postponed his plans to invade the United Kingdom. But today, we're going to ask, what if? What if things had worked out differently? What if the Germans had won the Battle of Britain? Would they have invaded Great Britain? Could they have invaded Great Britain? Did they have the means and the facilities and the plans to launch an invasion of the United Kingdom? And how would the British have responded? What would Britain have looked like under Nazi rule? They're absolutely fascinating questions, and I can't wait to delve into them. My guest today is Professor Gary Sheffield, who is a Professor of War Studies at the University of Wolverhampton in the UK, and he's an absolute expert on this subject. He knows everything about the Battle of Britain. He knows everything about Operation Sea Lion, and I can't wait to hear his insights into this most amazing chapter of history. I hope you enjoy it.
A date which will live in infamy.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor General.
There's a second plane just crashed into the World Trade Center. I think we have a terrorist attack.
This was our final tower.
Gary, it's great to have you on the program, and we're talking about Operation Sea Lion, which really must be one of history's greatest what-ifs, isn't it?
I think so. It seemed to be in the summer of 1940, there was a real opportunity for Nazi Germany to invade Britain, to knock Britain out of the war. And if that had happened, well, who can tell? But certainly the course of the Second World War and indeed world history would have been very different. But I have my doubts about whether it actually could have really have happened. But it's a great might have been.
Well, I'm looking forward to discussing that with you in more detail. Before we get to that, why don't you give us an overview of this military situation in 1940 when the Germans were considering an invasion of the UK?
Well, that's right. I think we need to go back to the 10th of May 1940 when the Germans launched their major attack into the Low Countries, the Netherlands, and Belgium, and then into France. We need to bear in mind that in 1940, beginning of 1940, everybody thought that France was a strong major military power, including the Germans themselves. And the scale of the defeat of the French and their allies principally the British, took everyone by surprise. And so in 6 weeks, the Germans had destroyed French defences. The French army actually fought, I think, a lot better, particularly in the second phase of the campaign, than they're often given credit for. But by mid-June 1940, it's all over and France has been defeated effectively in 6 weeks. And that produces a completely unprecedented and unforeseen situation, that Germany is victorious in the West, and Britain, whose entire strategy had been based on fighting in alliance with France, suddenly found themselves on their own. Dunkirk is a miracle of deliverance, that the British really didn't think they were going to get many troops away at all. In fact, they lifted something like 300,000 off the mole at Dunkirk, and indeed off the beaches, and they got them back to Britain. Virtually all of their equipment had been left behind, but the men very largely were at home, although, you know, thousands, tens of thousands were marched off to prison of war camps. But this had this situation in which the British army was in absolute bits. Germany was triumphant, and everybody then started to think, well, what happens next? And there's two real things that could happen. There could be a form of peace patched up between Britain and Germany, a German invasion. But of course, in the end, neither of those things happened. But those are the two options that seemed on the cards in the early summer of 1940.
It's when you talk about the invasion of France and the huge victory the Germans had, I can't help but think about the First World War. And it was really a repeat of that situation. Germany coming into France, Britain assuming that they would go over and join France in this continental campaign against the Germans. The speed must have taken everyone by surprise, including the Germans themselves.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the Germans had not prepared for this level of, if you like, you can call it catastrophic success. Hitler and the generals and everybody was taken by surprise. Looking back on it, we can see that there was a real difference between the quality of the armies in 1940 compared to the First World War. In the First World War, the armies on the Western Front, give or take, were much of a muchness in terms of technology, in terms of morale, command, and all the rest of it. So it was a brutal attritional slogging match. But in 1940, there was a real imbalance because the French forces in particular simply were not up to the quality of the Germans. Not in terms of technology. In some ways, they had better kit than the Germans did. But in terms of command in particular, the Germans were a long way ahead. So the Germans produced this, what became known as a blitzkrieg victory, a lightning war victory. And as we said, it took everybody by surprise. And the key thing about that, as far as Sea Lion was concerned, is that the Germans, just as much as the Brits, were facing a completely unforeseen situation. They really had to make up policy on the hoof.
And that brings us to the German plan. So they're beyond their wildest dreams. They've now captured effectively all of Western Europe, only the Brits to face. So they came up with this plan for Operation Sea Lion. Tell us about the German plans for an invasion of Britain.
Well, it's really not true to say there was one plan. There was a series of plans. One of the big faults from the German point of view was that there wasn't what today we would call a joint approach. The army, the navy, the Kriegsmarine, and the Luftwaffe, the Air Force, were not working together. In fact, they came up with three very different plans, and the three German services had very different ideas and indeed varying levels of enthusiasm. Basically, the navy looked at what they were being asked to do with something approaching horror. The German navy at the beginning of the war was already much weaker than the Royal Navy. The Royal Navy was one of the greatest navies of the world, along with the Imperial Japanese Navy and the US Navy, but it was by far and away the biggest and most powerful navy in Europe. Now, the German Navy actually had come up in 1939 with Plan Z, which was quite an ambitious plan, which would have produced quite a formidable fleet. Problem was, from the German point of view, this plan was not due to become operational in full till 1946. So war actually came at least 6 years too early from the German Navy point of view. And then in the Norwegian campaign fought in April, May 1940, which, of course, the Germans actually won. They ended up occupying Norway, chasing out the British who came in to support the Norwegians. But actually, from the German Navy point of view, it was an absolutely pyrrhic victory because they lost extremely heavily in terms of ships. We can actually look at one particular action on the 13th of April 1940, the Second Battle of Narvik, a naval action in the port up in the Arctic north of Norway, in which one British battleship, HMS Warspite, plus its attendant destroyers, destroyed or caused to be destroyed eight German destroyers, four of which were scuttled by their own crews when they realised that they were going to be captured. Now, this basically halved an already inadequate number of destroyers, so smallish, medium-sized ships, really important for operating in the Channel, meaning that the German Navy really just could not see any way they could support an invasion of the English Channel unless it was a very limited invasion on quite a narrow front. Now, the German army, understandably, from their point of view, had a completely different plan. What they wanted to do was to land on a very broad front. They wanted to land from the Straits of Dover in the east to Lyme Bay in the English West Country, 150, 180 miles, something like that. Because for the very good reason, as General Hulder put it, that if they landed on a very narrow frontage, that it would be like feeding German troops into a sausage machine. In other words, the British Army could simply wait for them and actually destroy them as they came ashore. So the Germans wanted to land on a broad front for very good reasons. The German Navy wanted to land on a narrow front for equally good reasons. And so the two plans were mutually at odds. And the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, really they thought they could bring about victory without invasion at all, by destroying the Royal Air Force, by reducing Britain to the point at which the bombers could range across southeast England to carry out terror bombing of London. And so I think Goering, the German Air Force chief, was never very keen on the idea of an invasion anyway. So you don't have one German plan, you have three German plans, which are pretty incompatible.
The British must have been watching all this with a sense of trepidation. There must have been a fairly strong British plan in place to counter any German offensive across the Channel. Tell us about that. What were the British going to do?
Well, there was, but I think we need to be aware that some of the people at the top, all along, because of the enormous problems that the Germans would have had taking on and defeating the much greater size of the Royal Navy, were dubious about whether the German invasion was ever really a goer. So Churchill, speaking to the War Cabinet on the 10th of July 1940, said that he thought any German invasion would be I won't attempt to do the accent, but a most hazardous and suicidal operation. And on the following day, he said to his private secretary that he thought that the Great Invasion Scare was serving a most useful purpose. In other words, keeping people up to the mark. If people thought there was going to be an invasion, it was in the interest of the British government to let them think so. But actually, Churchill and among others were really very sceptical about whether it's ever going to work. But as far as planning's concerned, there's actually in effect there's two phases of plans. The first phase is in July, when the British Army is at its weakest, when the senior British commander, Field Marshal Sir Edmund Ironside, Tiny Ironside, called Tiny because, of course, he was 6'4" or about that tall. He came up with a rather uninspiring plan for what became known as cross defence. In other words, the shoreline where the invasion was going to happen was held very weakly. And the idea would be that the Germans, once they are ashore, would be hit by mobile counterattack formations based in the London area. And there'd be a series of stop lines. If anybody's ever wandered around the countryside in southern England to this very day, you can see concrete pillboxes quite often plonked down in the most inappropriate places. But this is part of these defences from 1940. The idea being that you would slowly fight the Germans as they ground their way forward. Really a sort of an updated version of 1916 First World War style attrition. Now, Ironside actually is removed. He actually retires. And the general who takes his place, at least in terms of defending Britain, is General Sir Alan Brooke, who, of course, later on becomes Churchill's senior military advisor. And, of course, after war becomes Lord Alan Brooke. Now, Brooke doesn't like this idea at all, which is just as well because Churchill doesn't. Because he thinks that the one time the British army has of really doing damage to the invading Germans is when they're on the beach, when they're at their most vulnerable. And so he scraps the crust plan and basically has the idea to fight them on the beaches, which is a very Churchillian term, to engage any German breakthroughs by counterattacks, counterattack formations. Churchill demanded the formation of leopard brigades. In other words, mobile brigades, which would be sort of sent among the Germans to sort of rip them apart as a leopard rips apart its prey. And just to show the measure of how serious the British took this, and perhaps a measure of desperation, the British had a plan to saturate the landing beaches with mustard gas. Now, in the Second World War, gas was not used on the battlefield by the British or by the Germans. There was a real taboo about using gas as a result of the First World War. But in this time of absolute desperation, the British were willing to throw that to one side. And so had the Germans landed on the beaches, they would have been greeted by chemical warfare, which actually was not used anywhere else on the battlefield in the First World War.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It sounds like a German, quite an audacious German plan met by desperate British plans. The big question, of course, though, it didn't proceed, obviously. This is history that didn't actually occur. What were the reasons that stopped the Germans from launching this invasion of England?
I think there are two reasons, fundamentally. The first one is, as I've said already, that significant parts of the German forces were not very enthusiastic. The Navy certainly wasn't. Neither was the Air Force, although for rather different reasons. And so had there been an enthusiasm by all three services and a really concerted push to make it happen, perhaps it would have done. But it simply wasn't that. It didn't come down to that, because the German Navy really couldn't see much further than the fact that they had only a sort of pitifully small force to put up against a much bigger one. So in the narrow waters of the English Channel, it's not the big ships, not the battleships and battle cruisers that count. Actually, it's destroyers and to some extent light cruisers. And if I tell you that the Royal Navy had about 70 to 80 destroyers in home waters in September 1940. The Germans had a total of 8. That actually tells you about how suicidal it appeared to be. And of course, in terms of actually transshipping men from the continental channel ports in France and Belgium and the Netherlands across to England, well, they really had very little in the way of purpose-built landing craft, very unlike what was to happen 4 years later when the Anglo-Americans were going back in opposite direction to Normandy. many of the troops who would have been taken across the channel were taken in channel, would have been taken in river barges, which were frankly unseaworthy, that they were very slow. They had to be towed by other ships. And it was a complete nightmare from the point of view of the Navy, German Navy, or for that matter, if you were a German soldier sitting on one of these things. So from that point of view, the German Navy were never very enthusiastic, and they simply could not promise to get the troops across the channel. The other reason, of course, is the Battle of Britain. Now, we today see the Battle of Britain very much in terms of being an air battle. In fact, even more specific than that, it's the battle between Fighter Command and the German fighters. That's, of course, critical, but there is more to it than that. The other element I would certainly mention is the role of Bomber Command, indeed Coastal Command, in attacking the German invasion barges. So as well as the fighters defending over southeast England, British bombers were attacking the invasion ports night after night and doing some quite significant damage to the German to the German barges. But above all, I think the key factor in persuading Hitler not to launch invasion of the Operation Sea Lion is the fact that the Luftwaffe could not win air superiority over southeast England. On the 16th of July 1940, Hitler issued Führer Directive Number 16, in which he set out four things which had to be achieved before the invasion could be launched. And the first one of these was the Royal Air Force had to be defeated, that they needed to have air superiority over the southeast of England, which could allow the invasion force to cross without being attacked by the air. And that simply never happened. It was touch and go on various occasions. The Germans on occasions did seem to be destroying the fighters of the Royal Air Force and killing the pilots at a greater rate than they could be replaced. But ultimately, they never quite managed to do it. And so the victory of Fighter Command is incredibly significant. It meant that the Germans were turned off of any idea of launching this invasion. And of course, it was the first real strategic defeat the Germans had suffered in the Second World War, and as such sent out a really important signal to the rest of the world, not least the neutrals, primarily, of course, at this stage, the United States, that the British were not only still in the war, they were actually fighting back and winning. But ultimately, with the Luftwaffe failing to get control of the skies over southeast England, Hitler recognized that it was a non-starter. And on the 17th of September 1940, so 2 days after what today is now commemorated as Battle of Britain Day, Hitler postpones Operation Sea Lion. One final point about this. All along, Hitler, I think, if he could have got away without attacking Britain and brought Britain to terms, he would have preferred that. He quite admired the British Empire, but also he quite feared the British as being doughty opponents. But his real enemy he saw as being Stalin's Russia and the Eastern Front. And already by this stage, he was starting to think about striking east rather than west. And so he turned to something which, from his point of view, was frankly easier to do. Something that could be done on land, didn't have to have these difficult maritime components of the operation. So in the end, a combination of things, of which I think that the defence of Fighter Command of southeast England persuaded him against it. So on 17th of September, Hitler takes the decision to postpone Operation Sea Lion. It's never entirely cancelled. It remains on the back burner for some time, but really, to all intents and purposes, that's it. He has suffered a strategic defeat against Britain, and he's never able to renew the threat.
You mentioned D-Day, and I think that's a really interesting comparison. I mean, D-Day took almost 2 years to plan, and the huge amount of resources that were required to cross the Channel and land a force in France. And Sea Lion was effectively D-Day in reverse. Let's speculate a little bit. Can you, in all the research you've done about this, Gary, can you see a way the Germans could actually have pulled this off?
To be honest, no. And I think that you've actually put your finger on it. Just look at D-Day. It took 2+ years of planning. a very well-organized joint tri-service approach in which the Army, Navy and Air Force, in fact, you know, multiple Army, Navy and Air Force, because it was an Anglo-American, Canadian thing, worked together in close harmony. Massive resources were poured into it. It's a completely different proposition than Sea Lion, which is done on a wig and a prayer. Of course, it never actually happened, so we can't say definitively what the outcome would like to be. But actually, interestingly, we got the closest next thing, which is that in 1974, at the old British Army Staff College at Camberley, they ran a Kriegsspiel, a war game, a map exercise on the invasion of Britain in 1940. And they got in some very big hitters. So, for example, Adolf Galland, who in 1940 had been a Messerschmitt pilot, was drafted in to role play Goering. Anyway, and so you had these senior officers from both Germany and Britain. They gamed the invasion of Britain out. And what strikes me is that the what actually happened in the game is pretty much along the lines I suspect would have happened for real. The Germans do succeed in getting their troops ashore. However, they're penned in on the beachhead by the British. Say the British, actually, there's an Australian division, which is in Britain at the time. And actually, that's involved very heavily in the fighting in this reconstruction 1940. There's also Kiwi forces who get involved. So the Commonwealth forces pin the Germans into the bridge, into the beachhead. The Germans simply don't have enough lift to get all of their troops across in one go. So even the divisions that land don't actually have their many tanks with them or much in the way of heavy artillery. The Germans do a major airborne drop, which actually is partially successful, but actually takes some very heavy casualties. And in the end, just as planned by the Royal Navy, a strong force of light cruisers and destroyers arrives on the scene, intercepts the second wave, bringing across the reinforcements, basically destroys it. There's very little left of it. And so the Germans are forced to evacuate what troops they've got left from England. And and about 10 days after Sea Lion is launched, that's really the end of it, and the last German troops are surrendering. So I say it's played out, and that strikes me as being as realistic an outcome to a German invasion as any we're likely to get. If I could just mention just one last thing, for me the killer piece of evidence about what the British expected to happen in 1940. Comes down to the fact that in August 1914, so at the height of the invasion scare, Britain decides to descend its one fully equipped armoured brigade, not to the south coast of England, but to Egypt, because they recognise quite rightly that whereas the invasion of England was unlikely to happen, and if it was, it would be stopped by the Royal Navy, there was a real threat to Britain's position in Egypt. And so that's where the reinforcements needed to be sent. And I think that was the right call, frankly, that the invasion of England was never likely to happen, or if it did happen, it would end in disaster for the Germans.
It's fascinating stuff. You mentioned the Australians there and this whole concept that had England been invaded, you know, the Australian forces could have found themselves fighting in the UK instead of North Africa. It's just fascinating to think about. But the one thing I really got out of that, Gary, that I thought was really important and probably something we overlook, not just when we talk about Operation Sea Lion or the Second World War, but warfare in general, logistics is so important in this. It's not just a case of Germany getting combat troops and tanks and artillery across the channel. They have to keep them fed. They have to get them ammunition. And if you're dealing with an amphibious operation like this, look at the issues they had around D-Day, even as well prepared as they were for D-Day. One of the ongoing dramas was the logistics of keeping that force supplied. That's obvious. That must be a huge factor it would have been a huge factor in the defeat of Germany had they tried this invasion.
Absolutely. I mean, as you rightly say, in Normandy in 1944, it's logistically incredibly well supported, but not everything went smoothly. There was a great storm, of course, about a fortnight into the campaign, which brought the ships coming across from England with supplies almost to a halt, and people started to run out of ammunition and petrol and what have you in Normandy. So, you know, even the best prepared operation is at risk from those sorts of things. And Operation Sea Lion was a very poorly planned operation. I keep coming back to it. The German Navy had it right from the beginning. It was not going to work. It absolutely wasn't.
Well, while we're looking into our crystal balls and wondering what might have been, let's ask some other questions about that. Were there other options for Germany in 1940, apart from this idea of a fairly slapdash invasion plan across the Channel? Did Germany have other options to defeat the UK in 1940?
I can think of three, actually. The first one is to do what they actually tried to do in reality, although majorly a little bit later. That is to starve the British into submission by attacking the Atlantic lifeline, by unleashing submarines in the Atlantic to try and sink supply ships so Britain starved into submission. Problem is, from the German point of view in 1940, they simply did not have the capability to do that. The Battle of the Atlantic was touch and go for the British, but in 1940, the Germans were a long way from inflicting the sort of defeat that the British feared they might be coming into in 1943. The second one, actually rather more realistic from the German point of view, is to try and terrorise the British into making peace. Now, had Fighter Command lost the Battle of Britain, the plan was to pull the remaining fighters' squadrons out of the southeast of England into the Midlands to hold them back, so when the invasion actually happened, if it did, there would then be a maximum effort from the Air Force to hit them on the beaches. But that, of course, would have left the southeast of England and critically London open to heavy bombing by day and by night, without air cover, which was there for real in 1940. Now, we know that Londoners, indeed people in other British cities, survived pretty intensive night bombing from September through to May 1941 without their morale collapsing. We know that Germans from 1942 to 1945 resisted day and night bombing from the RAF and the US AAF without capitulating. But who can tell what the situation would have been in 1940? Had the bombing been heavy enough, it's, I suppose, conceivable that the British might have sued for some sort of peace. But so much of this, I think, depends on the critical factor, which is who is the man in number 10? Does Winston Churchill become Prime Minister on 10th of May 1940, as he does in reality, or is it his rival, the Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax? Now, today, it seems so obvious that Churchill is the man who's going to be chosen to lead Britain through the Battle of Britain and the Blitz and all the rest of it to victory in 1945. But he was by no means the obvious choice in May 1940. He was a maverick. Many people, not least in his own party, the Conservative Party, did not trust him fully. The King and the Queen would have preferred to have had Lord Halifax as being Prime Minister. And my reading is that once Neville Chamberlain's authority had crumbled as a result of the Norway debate in early May 1940, when basically his majority in the House of Commons plummeted, and he clearly had lost the the confidence of many people in his own party. My sense is that the Prime Ministership was there for Halifax's taking had he wanted it. But again, my sense of it is that Halifax, and this is his greatest contribution to British politics and quite a distinguished career of public service, he had enough self-knowledge to realise he was not the man to lead Britain at this critical time. So he stood back and allowed Churchill to become Prime Minister. But had Halifax had a different approach, had he decided that he simply could not trust Churchill or thought it was his duty to become Prime Minister, I think then there's a possibility that Britain could have come to some sort of compromise peace, which would have in effect meant that Britain remained intact, the empire remained intact, but it handed over Western Europe to domination by Nazi Germany. So actually, I think the Germans' best hope of victory over Britain in 1940 is that Churchill does not become prime minister, Halifax does, and the Germans then intimidate the British, probably by mass bombing of London, into coming to some sort of compromise peace.
It's a terrible prospect, isn't it? This idea of Britain and Germany negotiating a peace to end the Second World War. It's incomprehensible. I think in all this, Gary, though, the big question that no one can really answer, but it's fun to speculate on. Let's imagine for a minute that Sea Lion had been successful. The Germans had launched it and had successfully invaded the United Kingdom. What would Britain, having been conquered by the Nazis, what would Britain have been like in those days of the war?
Okay, well, I'll give you a quick answer, then I'll give you the answer I really want to give. Because I think that Sea Lion was a non-starter, but had somehow it happened, I don't think that what would have happened in Britain would have been much different to what happened in any other occupied country. We, the Brits, tend to fool ourselves that somehow we would have been different. We wouldn't have been collaborating, we'd have been resisting. Actually, there would have been a mixture of collaboration, of resistance, but I suspect, as in occupied France, occupied Belgium and many other places, most people would have done neither. They would have kept their heads down and tried to get on with life. We know enough about German plans to know that life would have been pretty grim. There was the notorious blacklist of people who were going to be arrested, interrogated at the very least, quite possibly cast off to a concentration camp or shot. The male population, adult male population of Britain was going to be deported to the continent. It would have been utterly ghastly. But as I said, I really don't think it was likely to happen. What I think is horribly plausible, however, is that you do have this compromise peace in 1940. And undoubtedly, Britain would have got away with not having the worst of German occupation, but they would have progressively been sucked into the Nazi orbit. That Britain would have become increasingly authoritarian. Increasingly, it would have had to have given way to German demands for various things. And so I think Britain, it's entirely plausible, would have become a sort of semi-fascist state almost by stealth. I think the best depiction of this is in a historical thriller, Dominion, which was published by C.J. Sampson, published in 2012, I think, not that long ago. And he depicts exactly the situation in which Britain does come to peace with Germany in 1940. Interestingly, Sampson actually says in the book that originally he was going to set it in a Britain conquered by Germany, but realized that it was very unlikely to happen because of the things I've been talking about. But he comes up with something I think much more frightening in a sense. This idea that you actually have this authoritarian British state which becomes semi-fascist. So Oswald Mosley, for example, and the black shirts become respectable. Mosley is in the war cabinet as Home Secretary. The book is set in 1952, so 12 years after the supposed British defeat. And Lord Beaverbrook, who was a sort of rather, slimy press baron and a very sort of right wing views, he has emerged as the British Prime Minister. And what we actually see is this depiction of a state which doesn't become fascist overnight, but becomes fascist or at least semi-fascist by degrees. And without giving away too much of the plot of the book, one of the critical moments is that Britain needs to make a deal with Nazi Germany in order to increase the size of the British armed forces, because the British are actually busily trying to exploit their empire for all that it's worth. And there's something like a major civil war major insurrection going on in India. And the price they pay is that British Jews are to be handed over to the Germans. Now, all of that is horribly plausible. I'm reminded of the analogy. I wouldn't like to swear to the scientific reality of it, that supposedly if you put a frog into boiling water, it will hop out straight away. If you put a frog into cold water and gently warm it, by the time it gets to critical point, by the time it gets to boiling point, it's too late and the frog is doomed. In the same way, I can quite see people forming up behind a sort of right-wing semi-collaborationist government in 1940 because it seemed to be the only option. It becomes increasingly authoritarian or increasingly fascist. By the time people realise what's happening, it's too late. In the book, by the way, Churchill and Clement Attlee go into opposition and eventually form an underground resistance force. So I think that's actually the most realistic outcome of a British defeat in 1940, something along those lines.
Well, it's so terrifying, Gary, because of, as you say, it's such a near-run thing. I agree with you, certainly, that the conquest of Britain via an invasion was always unlikely. But as you say, a couple of things could have gone differently in British history, and this could have been the reality, the British making peace with the Germans and forming some sort of uneasy alliance to carry on. Just a terrifying prospect. But the whole thing is just, it's been really wonderful, Gary. I've really enjoyed this with you. A little bit of speculation, but also an analysis of the reality of this really difficult situation. As we say, it could have gone the other way very, very easily, and we could have seen a whole different history.
Well, thank you. Of course, the one good thing about alternative history is no one can ever tell you definitively that you're wrong, because nobody knows.
Exactly. It's I've really enjoyed it, Gary. It's been great having you on. We'll definitely get you on the show again to talk about all things history. Gary Sheffield, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much indeed, Matt. Cheers.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.